Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It's 8:04. The People's Champ is in the house, and we're here to tell you that Chicago Wolves are making big plans for their 25th anniversary. Get your season tickets now and receive exclusive benefits. Visit ChicagoWolves.com or call 1-800-THE-WOLVES. Studs, let's go! Hour three of the program tonight. My name is Lawrence Holmes, here with you until 10 o'clock. We have spent a lot of time talking about Yu Darvish and his injury. Had a bad bullpen session and is feeling some pain. So we've been discussing what that means for the Cubs as they approach the trade deadline, if it means they do nothing, if he's going to be back, all of those things. We're trying to figure those things out. If you've been paying attention the last couple of weeks to this show, we have been spending a lot of time talking about youth sports. And NBC Sports across the nation, whether it's the regionals like NBC Sports Chicago or NBC Sports Bay Area or Philadelphia, are going to run a program tomorrow called Fair Play, Youth Sports in America. And one of the guys that worked on this project is a friend of ours here on the show. We talk to him often. He is one of the hosts of the White Sox Talk podcast, too, at NBC Sports Chicago, and an award-winning producer on the video side. I enjoy him. He's great, and he's going to hang out with us for a little bit. His name is Ryan McGuffey. What's up, Guff?
What's going on, Lawrence? Always good to be on with you, man.
Same here. So tomorrow at 7:30 on NBC Sports Chicago, Fair Play Youth Sports in America is going to run. What is this documentary, and why should parents watch it?
I think we hear a lot. You know, we hear a ton about all of the negatives, you know, all the negative narratives of youth sports, whether it's overbearing parents or coaches or the financial aspect, AAU, and when the list goes on and on. But the purpose of this documentary was to kind of harp more about the things that don't get talked about as much, which are the positives. You know, whether it's just the purpose of playing youth sports, all the benefits you get from doing it. I mean, you and I both played for a long time, and there's life lessons that are learned, you know, throughout that we still apply to our daily lives as we speak. So this was a talk. I mean, you got to talk about the negatives sometimes to talk about the positives, which is okay. And this does a pretty good job of touching on a lot of the things that maybe are not talked about as much because they're not being pushed, you know, in a narrative form. I mean, it's a $15 billion industry, esports, which is incredible and insane at the same time. And you can easily see why, whether it's year-round sports or specialization and all of the other things that come with it. There's not a lot of kids that are going out doing 3-4 sports anymore.
No, that's true. And it's something that we've discussed on the good and the bad of that, on whether it makes sense to do. What's the segment that you helped put together?
So Sarah Locke, myself, and some of our talented photographers spent a lot of time with the White Sox ACE program, which I know you're very informed as to what that is.
Yeah, and the Amateur City Elite program. I'm actually looking forward to doing some stuff with ACE later on this summer.
Yeah, I mean, they've given out over kids who have played in that or been in ACE have been awarded over 100 scholarships. So we looked at the program, but we kind of dove a little deeper into some of the actual success stories that have come out of that program. One in particular of a young man who was shot 3 times. You know, he had chosen kind of a darker path for himself and was able to kind of honestly survive by being a part of ACE. And he comes back and talks to the kids who were a part of the program today and tells them his story. And we mic'd him up for it. And we interviewed everybody that could possibly be involved with ACE, from the White Sox all the way down to all the coaches, a lot of them who volunteer. And it's just, it's eye-opening. It's one of those things that, you know, I'm a parent, and you think you know everything until you start talking and diving deeper and reading more and exploring more and interviewing one person who is like, wait, what? And then you interview two more people and you're like, wow, there's a lot of layers here. There are a lot of people doing great things that aren't being talked about all the time. So we really, really dive. I mean, Sarah and I talked about making that ACE thing after Fair Play airs. We may turn it into its own half hour run here in Chicago, because it's that good. It's that important, and people should know about it.
For sure. The Amateur City Elite program, they're getting kids to college. They're getting them in front of evaluators at the major league level. And it seems to be having a really good effect on some of the underrepresented populations in the Chicagoland area, which I think is great. You said, you know, you're a parent. Are there any things that you took from this that you think might help you parent and navigate youth sports in the future?
Well, I mean, the number one rule right now that I have in my house is to have fun. And that, to me, is the most important thing. If my son, who's 7, going to be 8, if it's not fun for him, there's a strict no-quit policy in the house, but there's also a strict, you know, if this is not fun, next year, next season, maybe we try something else. But we're going to finish the ride this year, and then next year, maybe, you know, you want to play soccer, you want to play basketball, you want to play the piano. It's not specific to sports. I want him to be, you know, I want him to be open-minded and explore and try things for the first time that he might be nervous about and learn that he loves or learns that he doesn't like. And that's the number one rule in my house. And I think by talking to a sports psychologist, and I was in charge of all the podcasts nationally for this particular project. So from coast to coast, we talked to people who, whether they were coaches here in, like, for instance, Pat Boyle did one with Coach Travis Moore at Eisenhower High School, football coach. That guy is such an awesome dude. What a story he is. So we went very local and kind of hardcore. We talked to sports psychologists, and then we talked to every regional head to do a podcast with one big name. So I know, like, Buster Posey, for instance, is one. We had Doug Glanville. We had Kevin Youkilis, Damian Lillard. These guys all give their perspective, their experience about how youth sports help them and how they can, you know, how they see the future of youth sports and the positive of youth sports. There's a lot of great stuff that comes just from talking about the topic, whether it's you and me right now on the radio, or, you know, ask Chris Bryant, you know, ask Anthony Rizzo. Everyone has an experience, positive or negative. And it's, I think it's one of those things. It's the more you talk about it, the better it's going to be. It's going to help the current youth and the youth going forward, because the specialization stuff and, like, you know, parents kind of chasing their own dreams to their kids, that's very concerning. You see it every day. I see it every day. Absolutely. And it's just, you know, you wish you could just pop somebody in the throat sometimes, but it's just not that easy.
Yeah. You kind of want to shake people and say, you know, are you sure that your child is having as good a time as you think they are? Because I came upon this last night, Guff. I was talking about this and saying that I always wonder if kids are truly having a good time, or if they're appreciative of, you know, like, if it's just, man, you know, my parents are sacrificed a little bit to let me play travel hockey or travel baseball or figure skating or whatever else. And you go, I want to show my appreciation by not complaining or not quitting. And I always wonder about that for kids, if they're just kind of playing along because they know that their parents are trying to do the right thing for them.
Yeah, I mean, I actually totally agree. And, you know, I catch myself sometimes as my own worst enemy. And, you know, I'm the guy, you see a bad call in a youth basketball game that your son or your nephew or somebody's playing in, and you're about to open your mouth. And you're like, oh, wait, like, that guy, it's 7:30 on a Saturday morning, and this guy just rolled out of bed like me, and he volunteered to be here, and he's the only referee, and it doesn't really matter if the ball was inbounds or not. Like, right? I mean, that's kind of the stuff that, take a step back and put yourself in those parents or those volunteers. There are so many parents who are volunteers. I'm one myself, my son's baseball team, and, you know, I don't – I am far from perfect and far from knowing all the answers and the rules and specifics, but the one thing I really, 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 really want to make sure is that the kids, whether it's my kid or 10 other parents' kids, are just out there to smile and have fun and get the most, you know, when there's a kid who doesn't really know how to hold a bat, and you can walk up behind him, say, hey, take a step back for a second, you know, coach, don't pitch, and help him get in a batting stance and bend his knees, and he learns that power comes from his legs and his hips, and he keeps his elbow back, and that bat comes through and swings and makes contact, you know, just the joy on the kid's face. I mean, it literally, in the moment, it can almost bring tears to my eyes like that instant. It's that rewarding to see how something like that, just the quick coaching moment of a kid realizing, hey, look, I can do this, and the confidence he can carry. I saw a kid on our own team. You know, he started the season, he could barely throw a baseball, and he got a hit. He talked about it for the next two innings, and then he just ran up to his parents and was like, did you see what I did? And that to me, especially at the real low levels, we're talking like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. God, I mean, like, how is it? Like, when you break it down at its lowest level, just strip away all the layers and the money and all the other crap, that's what it should be about. And then we can talk about, you know, being 13, 14, 15 in high school and specialization and whether or not the kid's going to be a first-round pick, you know, later on. Because, I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that kids can play, like, year-round baseball and be 8 years old. That to me, it's not worth it, man. Like, you know, your kid, I'm sorry, the chances of your kid being Randy Johnson, you better keep playing the lotto, man, because...
Yeah, and the idea, you know, of us finding out when they're eight also, right? Like, it seems really impossible. Tomorrow, the name of the documentary is Fair Play, Youth Sports in America. It will air on NBC Sports Chicago at 7:30 p.m. Set your DVR or plan to watch the documentary. I know that I'm going to be in the house. There's another reason I wanted you on tonight, Guff.
All right, what do you got?
And I saw your tweet back at the story that the Tribune ran and David Hall wrote,
yeah,
about, yeah, the almost interview with Sammy Sosa. Considering all the things that have gone on with Sosa, can you walk us through how you guys got involved with possibly going down to the Dominican Republic to interview Sosa and all of the things that went into that?
Yeah, I mean, I remember my wife, I think we had just given birth to our second child. I can't remember. I think she was either pregnant or we had just given birth, and we were walking at a forest preserve trail. I remember this, like, I closed my eyes and just, like, remember the phone ringing. It was Cap. And he's like, hey, can you go to Miami? And I said, what are you talking about? When? Where, what are you talking about? It's like, we're getting Sammy Sosa tonight. Can you go to Miami? And I just kind of started laughing. And I was like, I won't even ask for details yet, but, you know, let's figure that out. Sure, I can. And as, you know, we get to the airport and David Haw is there and there's a Tribune photographer there, and we had two cameramen with me and Kaplan, and we get on the plane and there was this discussion, you know, we're getting Sammy, he's going to admit to steroids. And we had convinced like four people on the plane to change their seats. After we got on the plane, which I feel like it's just, it's absurd to even try to think to get one person to move these days. But anyway, we're driving or we're flying down to Miami and we're putting the questions together for, oh my God, like Sammy Sosa is going to admit steroids and it's going to be the bombshell, you know, this is going to blow up big all over the place. And I had opted to get, I said, you know, I'm going to buy the Wi-Fi while we're on here so we can communicate with the station and Tribune or whoever we need to. And as we're flying, I started getting these dark emails about, you know, I don't know, like things might be happening. And we got about 15 minutes out, and I was actually talking to David Hall earlier about this. We were about 15 minutes from landing. So we're descending, and you can see that we're coming up on palm trees in Miami. And I got this email. I was like, yeah, I think Sammy's getting cold feet. It might not happen. And by the time we got off the plane and onto the concourse, the interview was off. So how it all came together, I know the Cubs were involved. And because of the relationship with Kaplan and the Tribune, and then obviously with our relationship, they owned part of our network at the time, was Comcast Sportsnet. that's kind of, I think, how it all came together. And there's this like collective, there's going to be a print aspect of it, the still photography, and this video form that we were turning around immediately. And we literally got off the plane and it all blew up. And it was like all Sammy's representatives supposedly that that put the kibosh on it because they were worried about how he'd be perceived in the Dominican Republic. And it was really, really, it's as mad as I've ever seen. I've known David a long time. I know you have too. And I told him tonight, I'm like, that was as mad as I've ever seen him in his life. And then you have to drop down like 15 pegs before I find whatever the next time he was mad, because it was very infuriating. I mean, it was a Thursday night. I definitely remember that. And we literally took a shuttle to the Marriott Hotel and right by the airport. And we never literally saw anything about Miami. Took this shuttle the next day back. We're on an airplane at like 6 in the morning. It was very, very frustrating.
So what do you think is – how can the situation between Sammy believing that he should be beloved or some part of the Cubs organization and the Cubs saying, I don't know, because – you need to admit some things that you don't feel like you need to admit. How does this get resolved if it gets resolved?
There's only one way at this point. Otherwise, this storyline, you know, whether it's us going down there a couple, like a month ago or whatever, and I know E60's there in their piece and Sports Illustrated, this stuff's not going away unless Sammy and Tom Ricketts get in the same room together and just figure it out. And if whether they agree to disagree or Sammy says what Tom wants to hear, that it's going to be an uncomfortable conversation for two grown men. And the other option is don't do that and just have this thing go on until, you know, Sammy passes away, because it's just not going anywhere. And it's just, I feel like it's getting louder. I thought this would kind of like dissipate after the Cubs won the World Series, and it's just people are kind of coming out of the woodworks, and I know it's 20 years since 1998, but it's not, the message isn't, this is not going anywhere. And I think you would agree. I mean, it's a sports radio topic at least 4 times a year. And I just feel like there are people who, I don't understand it. I don't get it. You know, we talked about this after we did the NBC Sports Chicago interview with him, and it doesn't seem like it should be that hard. For everyone, it shouldn't be that hard for Sammy. It shouldn't be that hard for Tom Ricketts. It shouldn't be that hard for the Cubs. I know their ego's involved, and I get it, but God, I just feel like this is a problem that can be controlled.
I'm with you on that. It seems like a fairly easy fix, but we are talking about, you know, truth and ego,
yep,
and fame. All of those things and legacy, like all of those things are can be complicated at times. But I'm kind of like you. I feel like all's forgiven. Like when we go back to November of 2016, it felt like every sin that had happened between then and 1908 had been forgiven. That we saw the Cubs reach out to Steve Bartman, and you know, it just seemed as if everything was fine and nothing mattered because the organization had finally won a World Series. Yet here is this guy who believes that he played a role, and he did, played a role in making the Cubs a bigger national brand than they already were. And he feels slighted that he's not part of this. I mean, like, you know, you've been out to games. I've seen, name any ex-Cub over the last 20 years. I've seen Alfonso Soriano, you know, sitting there watching the Cubs play in the playoffs. Aramis Ramirez has been there. Like, all of these guys that have found their way back to the Cubs after maybe not feeling great about the way that they exited. And the one glaring guy is Sosa.
Like, Big Z punched teammates.
Right.
Like, he literally punched his own teammate. Sammy never punched his own teammate. He argued with his managers. He left on bad terms. He's back every year. And, like, you brought up Steve Bartman. And, look, that's a whole – the fact that he was ever even a topic is just – that's because I don't drink the Cubs Kool-Aid, so I don't – that's why it doesn't just resonate with me. But he has a World Series ring and Sammy Sosa doesn't. They bought 1,908 championship rings, and Sammy Sosa is not one of them. That just doesn't feel And again, look, I'm removed from the situation. I have zero dog in the fight, and it's up to them to figure it out. But it's just when you just kind of like break it all down and write the pros and cons, it just doesn't seem like it should be this hard. And it doesn't seem like it's going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah, and you're right. That it just kind of it felt like, oh, okay, this thing is dying down, and then it built back up again. And it's not something that I necessarily even like talking about on the air because, to a certain extent, it seems silly to me. But I mean, it is the news, man. And I appreciate you jumping on and giving your perspective, man. You have turned into quite the storyteller with your own words. I mean, I know you're good at doing it with pictures, but when it comes to your own words, you've gotten very good at it, sir.
Well, people like you, Lawrence, have given me a platform to do it and do it in a way that allows, you know, storytellers to tell their stories. So, I mean, thank you for doing that. Thank you for the compliments. And, you know, let's keep on keeping on. I love the podcast, too. I love it. It's fantastic.
Oh, you got it. Tomorrow's episode. I'm dropping a bonus episode tomorrow. You're really going to love it. It's
awesome.
It's all about the crazy sports history of the University of Chicago.
Bring it. I love it.
Guff.
I love it.
Be good, man.
All right, brother.
It's Ryan McGuffey, senior producer over NBC Sports Chicago, one half of the White Sox Talk podcast. He's an award-winning producer in his own right. He does, and he and Sarah Locke are, I mean, those two, man. You put them together, they come up with great TV. So tomorrow, you can check out the documentary on youth sports. It's called Fair Play, Youth Sports in America. It'll be on NBC Sports Chicago tomorrow at 7:30, we need to take a break. When we come back, before I get into the Sosa stuff, I wanted to share something that we did a couple weeks ago on youth sports. Since we're kind of on that, I wanted to share something that we did a couple weeks ago that you might find interesting as we continue this conversation about youth sports. We'll do that next here on The Score. Welcome back in. This segment being brought to you by Spot Hero. And finally, here's a way you can save time parking. Use Spot Hero anytime you park. First-time users can enter promo code SMART for $10 off. Spot Hero, park smarter. In Northwestern football, the Wildcats are coming off a 10-win season. They host Michigan, Nebraska, Wisconsin, Notre Dame, and more this fall at Ryan Field. Season and single-game tickets are on sale now at nusports.com. I appreciate you indulging me. We sometimes like to go in-depth on particular subjects. And over the last few shows, we've been talking about youth sports for a couple of different reasons. And a couple weeks ago, I had Robert Klimko, who writes for the MMQB.com and Sports Illustrated, on the show because he had talked about getting quarterbacks to the NFL and how that's changing in youth sports. So I wanted you to take a listen to this conversation that we had. Especially if you're a football parent, if you're the parent of a quarterback, you might find this interesting too. It starts off with me asking Robert about what the mechanism is for getting a quarterback to the pros. And we'll have that in just a second. But the whole conversation, you guys look panicked over there. What's wrong? Is it not loading up?
We're just trying to make sure it's good to go. It's okay. Good. We're good.
All right, we're good? All right, so let me try that again. The interview starts off with me asking Robert what the mechanism is for getting a youth...
Hold on.
Wait, so we're not good?
Herbie's there. Switched on me. All right, now we're good.
Wait, so let me see. In 3, 2... I swear this is a really good conversation. How do youth quarterbacks get to the NFL? That's what Robert told me.
So I think one thing when you notice when you cover the league is that quarterback is a really exclusive position in terms of demographic and socioeconomic. So we wanted to see, we looked at every quarterback in the 2016 draft, actually. I think it was 14 or 15 guys that ended up getting drafted, and wanted to look into their backgrounds to see what they all had in common. And what they all ended up having in common is, you know, they came from two-parent homes, college-educated parents, upper middle class to upper class backgrounds. You know, we determine that by looking up the median home values of their state compared to the homes that they actually grew up in. Access to individual coaching and instruction, which has become, you know, as you know, a cottage industry with all of these names popping up as quarterback gurus and guys who can charge crazy amounts of money to families with kids who are aspiring quarterbacks. And I think Hackenberg's career is kind of a good example of the pitfalls of this really narrow path that exists towards becoming an NFL quarterback, because Christian's dad spent thousands of dollars flying him across the country to meet with various QB gurus that helped him get recruited, that helped him thrive at the high school level and early on in college. And then you saw him regress in college. And I think that, and basically what I tweeted was that having access to resources and having money has become so much more important in terms of becoming a successful college and NFL quarterback than, you know, the things that are actually important when you get to the highest level of quarterbacking, which is, you know, the processing speed and mental acuity and composure and calm under pressure. And so you see a lot of these guys kind of flame out, and then we complain about, you know, young quarterbacks in the NFL not seeming to get it and never seeming to pan out. And I think part of the reason for that is that we have a small talent pool from which to choose from.
So are we seeing, if you're a kid that's in the poorer suburbs of Chicago or playing in CPS, and maybe your family can't afford to send you to a quarterback guru, are we seeing you being kind of priced out of the position?
Well, yeah, and it's not only that. It's in a lot of inner city places and rural places, it's coaches that don't have any experience coaching quarterbacks. So, you know, you put the best athlete in that position, and he's essentially a glorified running back who throws the ball 10 times a game. You know, maybe that kid, under the right circumstances with the right coaches and parents who could take him to all these different 7-on-7 events and all-star camps and meet with QB gurus that are going to go over his mechanics, maybe that kid was actually a better candidate to be an NFL quarterback than a Christian Hackenberg. But we'll never know, because he's not going to get a scholarship offer. He's not going to get the proper experience. And, you know, he's going to play wide receiver at the next level or running back.
That's what I was wondering, if those kids end up getting moved off of the position because they can't afford it. When I was going back over your piece and going through the conversation via Twitter, I kept thinking about the Real Sports piece that they did on youth sports and how it has turned into a multi-million dollar industry where you have parents, you know, putting their kids on travel teams and looking at it as, well, here's an opportunity to get my kid a college scholarship or maybe get them to the pros. And I got a little bit sad about it, because it feels as if you're a kid that does have some talent and you do need – like, can you get sufficient enough coaching that if you have extreme talent, you might be in the same boat as some of these guys who can pay for the help that they're getting?
Yeah, you know, I think it's luck of the draw in a lot of cases, because, you know, guys like Jameis Winston, and to use an example from my story, Cardale Jones ended up at high school programs where, the kids weren't wealthy. They didn't come from wealthy backgrounds, but they had tremendously experienced and capable high school offensive coaches. So for a lot of the kids that do make it out of Purdy to the NFL, that's often the case. They met somebody who, you know, was a guru at their high school. It's hard for me to sit here and begrudge parents paying a lot of money for their kids to meet, you know, these QB coaches and to learn more. You know, maybe that was a really fun time for Christian Hackenberg, and I'm sure now that he's pocketed however many million dollars he's made in the NFL, he's not blaming his dad, right? He's happy with the way that his life has gone. You know, obviously he'd like to compete, but, you know, I think that the solution for this is for entities like the NFL and, you know, the NBA and Major League Baseball to say, you know, we need to create programs in, you know, some of our cities where the most of our talent's coming from, and a lot of underprivileged places, and say connect some of these youth programs and high school programs that are underprivileged with better coaching.
I wonder too if you're Hackenberg, and you're right, we don't know that this hasn't been the time of his life, getting to this point and getting drafted high and making it to the NFL, even though you're not playing at the NFL level, have been great. We don't know that that's not the case. But I wonder if the the actual ability of the player gets stunted, and maybe that person gets cheated because of the other experiences that one could have without specializing so early on.
Yeah. Well, most of these guys who make it to the NFL as quarterbacks or at any position played multiple high school sports. So it's not as though football has become this year-round thing. I think all 32 first-round picks played multiple high school sports. But the thing is, in the summers, and say whether it's during the winter or the spring when you're not playing a sport, it's about having a parent or a person in your life who can take off work and make sure that you're getting to these Elite 11 camps and make sure that you're getting to these opportunities to play 7-on-7 football and things like that. Having that person invest in you often makes people work harder and often makes people invest in themselves and in their own careers. And I think quarterback is unique because you can make it in college football. You can make it in the NFL as a defensive tackle or a wide receiver. You're going to get coached up, and you don't have to do all this stuff on the side. But quarterback, it's like playing the violin now. You know, you have to have the training. You have to have the extra work.
It's a fascinating discussion, and I'm so glad that we're having it because, you know, there's a parent right now that's weighing the options of whether or not it's worth it for their family to invest this way in their student. What would you advise them on how to go about finding the right fit with one of these guys, and what's worth it and what's not?
Yeah. Well, when I was writing the story, I talked to Bruce Feldman, who covers college football and has wrote several awesome books. I can't remember the name of his quarterback-centric book, but if you just Google Bruce Feldman quarterback, you should pick it up. He talked about how a lot of these cases that he's kind of followed in recruiting, where kids were highly recruited and they traveled across the country at all these camps and QB gurus, in a lot of cases were burnt out by the time they got to the next level or by the time it came time to kind of turn it on and try to make it to the NFL. And so his advice was, you know, just to go at your kid's pace. You know, if he wants to spend the summer goofing off or playing travel baseball instead of football or whatever, you know, that's got to be his prerogative. It's got to be the kid pushing you to spend this kind of money on the training if you got it, if you have the money, as opposed to you pushing the kid.
Robert Klimko of Sports Illustrated joining me for a few minutes here on The Score. Follow him on Twitter at Robert Klimko. This has nothing to do with your piece whatsoever, but you do cover the NFL. And I was thinking about this the other day. The way that we talk about NFL players during this dead period before training camp, I wonder if we need to reassess that. And the way we talk about it is, oh no, I hope the coaches have got these guys in line because these next 6 weeks, no one's going to be looking after them. We don't say that about any other athlete. We don't say that about baseball players when they leave for the winter. We don't say that about NBA players during the summer. But we do say that about NFL players for the next 6 weeks. I know some of it is justified, but some of it is not. And I kept thinking to myself, at some point I want to talk about this on the air. And I figured you might be someone I could get some sort of historic perspective on with this.
Yeah. Well, I think there's three kinds of NFL players this time of year. There's the guys you don't have to worry about. And, like, that's the vast majority of the league. I would say that's, like, 70% of the league. Like, they're going to go get their work done. Maybe they don't come in and pass their conditioning test on the first day, but they're gonna pass it on the second day of training camp. Like, those guys are rock solid. You're not worried about them. The agents aren't checking up on them all the time. Then the other 30% is split into two groups. There's the guys who already got drug tested, already got their marijuana test out of the way here in the first few weeks of the year. In a lot of circles, they call that test the golden ticket because that means you can smoke for the rest of the year and you're not going to be tested again for marijuana. And those guys are kind of in the clear too. Like, you don't have to worry so much about them. And then the third group is the guys that don't have the golden ticket yet. And they're sitting there itching and trying to stay out of trouble and trying to stay away from you know, some of the guys from home who are bad influences, and you got to check up on those guys. You know, I know that we don't talk about other athletes like this, but, you know, I think the NFL probably has more discipline issues and drug testing issues and positive tests around, you know, training camp, come training camp time of year, than most of the other leagues. You know, so I think some of that is a little bit justified. I know that, I know personally agents who travel a lot this time of year just to check up on guys. You know, they're back and forth between Miami and Los Angeles making sure their guys are good.
That was my conversation with Robert Klimko of Sports Illustrated and the MMQB. I thought I would pass it along as this conversation about youth sports continues. I thought what he had to say was valuable and interesting. And it's something now that is on my radar to pay attention to, is the idea of, will kids get, kids who can play quarterback who don't have dollars, will they get a fair chance to play the position? Is it truly a meritocracy if we're seeing kids kind of buy their way into the spot? Someone texted me and was like, well, Donovan McNabb's from Dalton. Where'd Donovan McNabb go to high school? Went to a private one, right? And that was almost 30 years ago now. What we're talking about are guys like Christian Hackenberg, who made their way into the NFL, got drafted in the second round, and probably won't ever really play. But they were able to game the system to the point where they look the part. And then once you get to the highest level, the athleticism catches back up and they can't play. Back after this on The Score. This segment being brought to you by Spot Hero. And finally, here's a way you can save time parking. Use Spot Hero anytime you park. First-time users can enter promo code SMART for $10 off. Spot Hero, park smarter. I love Spot Hero. They don't even pay me to say that. But I do. I use it a lot. It's nice when you only have to be downtown for a couple hours and you're like, oh, I don't want to have to deal with paying the man. So I'd rather pay a business. It's great. Okay. I had a great time over at White Sox today. Layla Rahimi hit me up and was like, hey, I got some tickets. You want to come hang out? Like, yeah. I was like, no, no. And then she was like, Herbie's coming. And I was like, oh, great. All right, I'll be there. So I got to go to a baseball game today with Layla Rahimi, Jason Goff, Herb Lawrence, and Roki, old producer of this show, Melissa Rakitis, which is great. I miss my little Roki. It was so good to see her. We had a good time. Yeah, great time, actually. I had them scout seats, man. And it was... I've been in the scout seats a couple times before. Herbie, this is a bucket list thing for you, right?
Yes, 100%.
And did it live up to your expectations?
Exceeded it.
I know. It's pretty great. So you get the scout seats. They have like a buffet before the game. So I had a little prime rib and couscous. Sidney Rice. And then you go out there, the dogs are free, the popcorn's free, the drinks are free until the seventh, I believe. And then in the seventh inning, you can go back inside. I mean, you can go in and out the whole time. In the seventh inning, you can go back inside and they got like a dessert table, like all set up. Had myself a sundae. It was great. I'm not giving up my 500 level seats. I still enjoy section 531. And I plan to spend more time there, but it was great, wonderful company. You know, talking baseball with Layla like she does on her show every night on NBC Sports Chicago. Having Jason there to add some flavor to the conversation. Herbie's actually paying attention to the game and what's going on with the White Sox. and Roki for poops and giggles. It was a pretty great all-star team that we put together to go watch the White Sox play today. And then trying to keep an eye on what the Cubs were doing. Because it would be the effect of on us on what time we go on. Like, we went on a few minutes late because the Cubs game, that mud stomping that they put on the Dodgers today, took a little longer than your usual game. So we went on a little bit later than we ordinarily would. But it was great. Saw a lot of good people at White Sox today. They always make it nice and convenient. Oh, it was a free t-shirt Thursday, so got a cool new Sox t-shirt too. I was wearing my Chance the Rapper White Sox cap. Someone asked me, how many White Sox caps do I have? I think I have eight. Seven or eight.
Brooks Boyer came over?
Yeah, Brooks came and said, what's up? Yeah, that was cool. It's just good people and a good time. It's amazing what that can do, you know. Because ordinarily, I would not allow myself to go to a game in the middle of a day knowing that I had a four-hour show to do. But it ended up being worth it. I'm glad that I went. When we come back, oh, I should tell you this. This segment is being brought to you by Spot Hero. That's right, again. Spot Hero, use it. You're parking downtown. If you're a first-time user, use the promo code SMART for $10 off. Spot Hero, park smarter. Since we were having the discussion about Sammy Sosa, and you heard what Ryan McGuffey said earlier this hour, you may not have heard what Bruce Levine said. Maybe we'll bring that back for you. But I wanted you to hear Ben Ryder, who wrote the Sammy Sosa story for Sports Illustrated, and then I would like for us to discuss it. I'd like to discuss Sammy's role in Cubdom. We'll do that next here on The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.